Hey, you want that to go?
Get your news takeouts. Here in the studio is Louise Story from our partner, the New York Times, and Todd Zwillick down in Washington. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning, John.
So I'm confused, Todd Zwillick. In the middle of a recession, in the middle of talk in Washington about a second stimulus package, Obama is apparently going to roll out a positively Nixonian-sounding domestic spending freeze. What's going on?
Well, it smacks of fiscal responsibility, doesn't it? Freezing all increases in discretionary spending across the government. Now, this is on government programs except at the VA, which is health care and housing for veterans, DHS, which is Homeland Security, and, of course, defense. Nobody wants to mess with that.
It sounds like an almost Reagan kind of a program, and we're going to hear about it specifically in the State of the Union address, right? Is he trying to appeal specifically to conservative Democrats and Republicans?
I think he's trying to appeal to all those people, but also independents who were, you know, I hate this phrase, I'm sorry, game changers, but who were the game changers in Massachusetts, and they're afraid.
Were they the game changers in Massachusetts, Todd?
They were the game changers in Massachusetts, but maybe across the country. But on this domestic spending freeze, it's really unclear how this is going to work. Don't forget, spending is only one side of the equation in deficits. Revenue is the other side. And unless tax revenue goes up and business improves, cutting spending doesn't really improve the bottom line as much. It's a two-sided coin. Also, this is just a presidential proposal, John. It's up to Congress to decide how much to spend. And their power under Article 1 of the Constitution is in spending money. They don't like to have it curtailed. And the other thing I should point out, that discretionary spending, cut it, freezing it, is great. It's going to be politically popular and does help with the deficit. It's not where the real money is. The real money is in the entitlements. Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security, and defense, none of those is included in this proposal. That's where the big money is in the long term.
All right, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Maybe we'll see some specific numbers tomorrow night. Thanks.
Definitely not a spending freeze in the world of music. Yesterday, the U.S. Justice Department cleared the way for a huge merger between two of the world's biggest concert promoters. And Louise Story, our partner from the New York Times, is here to explain it to us. Who's merging?
So we've got Live Nation, you know, they're a giant concert promoter, and Ticketmaster, which is the biggest ticket selling and artist management company. And what's interesting is, you know, Ticketmaster has been around from the 70s. They've been reviled off and on by artists. You probably remember Pearl Jam in the 1990s,
right.
You know, taking a case to the DOJ because they wanted to sell tickets under $20. But of course, Ticketmaster didn't want that. And Live Nation has been more of an upstart. So now you've got the upstart joining the Goliath. It's a merger that Bruce Springsteen has warned is a near monopoly. But the problem is, it's a vertical integration. That's in business where you take the whole pipeline process and merge it rather than direct competitors. And it's much more difficult for the DOJ to fight cases against vertical integration.
Meaning that they're not duplicating services.
That's right.
Right. They're just more
They're handling
the
different parts of the music production, music concert situation. So what the Department of Justice has done is imposed some rules on them about this merger. They've said, for instance, that this merged company cannot punish venues if they, for instance, don't use them for concert promotion but want to use one of their artists. They can't do that. They can't share data between divisions. So they just put some restrictions on.
You know, Celeste, what do you think? You think Louise is a Pearl Jam fan?
Oh, yeah.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think? Louise?
You know, I think I prefer Madonna, who is a Live Nation artist. I kind of have a soft spot there for those 80s hits.
And she's quite the businesswoman also.
She is
correct.
Louise Story, thanks so much. Business and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
So in yesterday's show, we talked with two doctors about the provocative question of whether the experience of childhood sexual abuse is traumatic to the victim and exactly when. It got this listener thinking about an event in her own life.
This is Colette. When I was younger, I visited my family doctor, and he touched me inappropriately. The interesting thing was, I didn't realize it until years later that what he did was wrong, but I'm not traumatized by the event. I knew then something wasn't quite right, but, you know, it happened, and I'm like, you know, that wasn't right, but it hasn't affected me. So, you know, I just think this discussion of whether, you know, something is trauma at the time or trauma upon recognition of the event not being appropriate is interesting and relevant.
Indeed. Colette didn't tell us if she ever reported the incident with the doctor, aside from mentioning it to us. But Clancy, another listener, told us the whole issue is getting young people to report and not traumatizing them about their disclosures.
I completely understand the importance of calling this event a trauma from sort of the adult perspective. But the problem is that because of our positioning the event as trauma, but not clarifying details of the event, you end up with a lot of people out there who never report the sexual abuse to anyone and who themselves don't necessarily feel like they were victims because their understanding of the event was when it happened, it was not traumatic.
Wow. Hi, this is Megan calling from Detroit, Michigan, and I have to say I'm horrified by assertions that some child sexual abuse victims are not traumatized by what happens to them. I agree that child sexual abuse creates a wide range of different reactions in many different people, but to say that it is not inherently traumatic when someone close to you breaks your trust and abuses you is disturbing, to say the least.
Well, we suspected we would get responses to our discussion of child abuse yesterday. Thanks for that, Megan. And you can listen to the podcast of yesterday's segment and hear Dr. Clancy talking about her theory at thetakeaway.org.
Thanks to all of you for your takes and your stories. We want to hear about you, about anything that you hear that touches a nerve. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post a comment at our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, in the midst of the Haiti coverage, maybe you felt like this listener.
Not about news, it's about what sells and what can be used to excite people, and most of all, what can be used to scare people.
We're going to be talking about some of the graphic images coming out from the streets of Haiti. Have you seen some of these photo essays,
Jen? Indeed.
I had to stop looking at some of them. I mean, I understand some people's reluctance or, I guess, distaste about some of the images, but do they have real news value?
Well, tough calls for photographers, that's for sure.
Absolutely. We're going to be talking about that more in just a few minutes.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.